The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, June 15th, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist Duff McDonald, author of The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism, and The Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. It's MBA, not NBA.
Not LeBron James.
Not LeBron James. That's not a moral failure. It's just, what are you going to do? Folks, today is a technical day at the Majority Report, so we are not broadcasting live. And by technical day, I mean Matt had to go to what? A wedding?
A wedding in Denver.
Another wedding.
It's the first wedding I think I've missed before.
I think there was
actually
another
last
wedding.
Year I did. Yeah,
there was another wedding. It's the second wedding he's been to in his life. And that's not the technical part. The technical part is that apparently Michael decided that if Matt was going to go to a wedding, that he would take vacation. So we found this out, and I'll probably be in the office cleaning. Somebody's got to clean this place. It's a disaster in here. And so I'm cleaning. Matt's partying at a 4-day wedding, apparently in Colorado. That's the way it works. And Michael has just decided that he's going to take vacation. So we have this pre-record. Interesting stuff from Duff McDonald. Tomorrow on the program, we will have one more day of pre-records. And I won't tell you about all that's going to be there, but I've got two words for you. Al Franken. Has nothing to do with the show, but it's just two words. No, that's not true. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Duff McDonald on his new book, The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism, and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. Duff McDonald, author of The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism, and The Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. Welcome to the program, Duff.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
So, all right. So put, I got to say, your book really excited me. I don't want to jump ahead of myself, but we've had Bill Lozonik on this program multiple times over the years, and he's one of the few people I keep referencing. So, but without getting ahead of myself, but please place Harvard Business School in the context, broadly speaking. It's been around now for almost 110 years. Broadly speaking, in the context of American business, and I guess by extension, American culture.
Sure. American business was around before the business schools, and Harvard Business School does not set the agenda for American business. But having been one of the first graduate schools of business in the country, and long been the most influential in terms of both the success and diaspora of its graduates, as well as the sort of intellectual product coming out of it. They are the lead horse in the academic side and intellectual underpinnings of business in the country. So they're they serve a couple functions. They generate new ideas. They ratify ideas that are already out there in the business world. And they, graduate about 1,000 people a year. So the number of Harvard MBAs and the network that they constitute is one of the most powerful the world's ever seen.
And in terms of placing people, or I should say, in terms of the, I guess, C-suites, if you will, executive suites around the country, they're extremely prominent. I mean, significantly more so than even their number two rival, which I guess would be close to like Stanford or something like that.
Yeah, you know, the business schools arose because of a need with the success and scale of American business a century ago for a new class of a person in the business realm, and that was the professional manager. You know, these guys were never graduating buccaneering entrepreneurs. What they were graduating was technocrats who can work inside large organizations. And having, you know, they've got Harvard behind them, obviously, the brand, but, you know, arguably have eclipsed the university in terms of specific influence in the last several decades. And they basically are the most effective catalyst for a business career you can think of. A Harvard MBA really is a ticket to power and success.
So when the school did start, tell us about the, I guess, the original intent or the original, I mean, a lot of it sounds like justification, or it quickly sort of became that, it appears. But tell us what the original intent was.
Well, you know, it came about in the dawn of the progressive era, right? When American elites were actually concerned, as now, with the encroachment of big business into public life. And at the same time, you know, it was the center of elitism in the Northeast anyway. And when the sons and of the elite started to voice interest in careers in business as opposed to the professions, which historically they went into, you know, law, clergy, military, Harvard felt a need to expand its credentials so that, you know, they weren't losing all their children to other schools. But what they said at the outset in response to suggestions that a vocational school, you know, that would teach bookkeeping or something was beneath the idealists at Harvard, was that they weren't looking to just churn out accountants and bookkeepers and functionaries. They were looking to churn out enlightened businessmen who specifically understood their responsibilities to the rest of society. And that's the first sticking point for me, which is, this is a goal you set for yourselves and you have failed to live up to it. And not only failed to live up to it, often acted in ways completely contrary to that original mission, and arguably have completely forgotten it at this point.
Was I mean, in your opinion, was your sense that enlightened? I mean, what kind of work is that doing in 1900 versus or 1910 versus today? To the extent that they still sort of perceive that as their goal.
Well, I'm, you know, 100 years ago, it would entail things like not busting strikes with violence and not, you know, engaging in outright corruption or monopoly or collusion, because the public at the time was worried that business had so much power, it was just doing whatever it wanted. You might be able to make a case that it's the same things going on today, although it shifted, obviously. You know, the culture is interested and wants business to act in ways that rise above its own narrow, profit-driven self-interest. And the sort of influence that the school has had, particularly in recent decades in the rise of shareholder capitalism has basically been the opposite. They have narrowed and helped to narrow and justify the narrowing of focus of corporate executives to their own individual and or organizational needs with complete disregard for the rest of society. One great example would be tax inversions. HBS wasn't behind this, but companies relocating their domiciles internationally to avoid paying U.S. taxes is just a flagrant disregarding of the responsibilities they owe to the communities in which they operate. But the executive class is completely okay with doing that in the name of competition.
And I want to get up to guys like Michael Jensen and this notion of CEOs and corporate leaders basically running their businesses for the sake of shareholders, which is not uncoincidentally often them themselves. But let's before we get there, I mean, let's work through some of the eras, because the hard part, I don't know that we can ever be aware of, is like, how much does the culture impact, and the business culture and just the broader culture, you know, which direction is this flowing in? And I imagine it feeds itself, but walk us through the changes in Harvard Business School, just broadly speaking, because they follow different sort of, I guess, business theories du jour, if you will, and in some instances they make them. They create these theories. Yes.
Sure. Here's one that has got all sorts of sides to it. The emergence and rise of the human resources function. Harvard claims that one of its early prominent professors, Elton Mayo, is the father of the human resources industry, and about the ideas that, you know, you should be concerned about your employees' mental health as well as their financial rewards. And in the simplest sense, it's true. But at the same time, Mayo was a charlatan. He was a pretend doctor, and his theories were more about pseudo-psychology. And in an era when companies wanted to find out ways to resist employee demands to pay them more. And one of the answers to that was, well, what about if we care about you as well? And it was basically an early feint, a dodge from the desire of employees to be rewarded appropriately for their work. What did he give rise to? He gave rise to sort of the charade in so many companies that the caring about people goes all the way down to the people on the front lines when, as you just pointed out, in terms of management, if you look at shareholder rewards and stock options and salaries, the evidence is fairly overwhelming that the managerial class, along with the shareholder class, has basically hijacked all of the profit of business and, you know, left the non-managerial people to see their fortunes stagnate in the face of exploding executive pay.
Yeah, I want to get into that in the broader critiques it might imply about capitalism, but there is definitely a quality about the history of this school that there just seems to be sort of I don't want to say swindles, but even like the origins of it, as you describe it in the book, this idea that we need to have the Harvard imprimatur for these industries that our sons are getting into, rather than I mean, there's just a quality of this. Like there's they're in the rationale business on some
absolutely.
Level. And that,
yeah. So
go ahead.
Let's just talk about the money, right? Because the money is what really matters here. So you've got a school that claims it studies business objectively and teaches students how to have an enlightened approach to managerial decisions. But the faculty consults for the companies they are supposed to be viewing objectively, therefore rendering their objectivity invalid. The school seeks donations from the same corporate, the subjects of their research. And in addition to that, you know, their cherished method of learning is the case method.
Yes.
Which is supposed to be real stories about real companies, but they are companies are given veto power over them. And also they all have positive bias and sort of contribute to the mythology of the omnipotent CEO and all and allow companies to claim foresight when generally, as we all know, so much of anybody's success is as much circumstance and luck as it is anything else. And so they basically become less of a faculty that stands outside the system and evaluates it dispassionately, and more a justifier, a rationalizer, a cheerleader, and a solicitor of donations from the people that they're supposed to be covering. It's a complete farce that they would suggest that there is anything objective about the way that they are teaching their students. They are teaching them a pro-business, pro-capitalism stance that makes all sorts of implicit assumptions, doesn't bother addressing the most important ones, and just basically acts as a channel for whatever the corporate rationale is of the day to get out there with a stamp of the academy on it.
I mean, the whole enterprise does feel to me like it's almost like internal training for a specific company. It's just like on a broader level, on some level. I mean, explain like the case method of, because this, I mean, this to me strikes, over the, I'm trying to like, you know, like I've had occasion to see, you know, internal videos for corporations. And this sort of the training, the whole enterprise just feels like it's an extension of training for a corporation, but it's just broadly, you know, more generic. And the case method seems to be that to me.
Yeah, basically what they've done is they have provided a function whereby corporate America can outsource its junior executive training function. You know, if American companies actually cared as much about personnel and human resources development as they claim they do, they wouldn't be outsourcing the most crucial part of their human resources challenge to someone else, which is basically what they've done. So you've got and in particular for the consulting industry, because you know, consulting, management consultants, McKinsey most prominent among them, have a never-ending hunger for young recruits who can parachute into companies and basically BS about problems that they know nothing about. And the case method is the perfect training for that. You know, you go home one night and read your 30 pages about a company and go in the next day and stand up in front and try and impress your classmates with your idea of how you were going to make this change at a giant, you know, typically multinational corporation, that the extent of your knowledge is reading one night's worth of stuff, and you're all getting up there, quote, learning from each other, telling each other how you would solve complex problems that are human problems, that are organizational problems. And it's a bunch of students sitting there convincing themselves that they understand what management is by pretending to manage. It makes no sense. There's a professor at McGill, Henry Mintzberg, who's written extensively on this. One of his books is called Managers, Not MBAs, and basically saying not only are these schools distorting and perverting the notion of what a manager is, they're not even teaching it properly because it's all fantasy land in a classroom. You know, imagine if you if your doctor was trained by sitting with a bunch of other medical students and pretending to operate on pretend bodies. Would you sign up to go in there and have your gallbladder removed by someone who did 2 years of that?
Right. I mean, there's everything is so abstract. It's almost like you feel you are you really understand battle after, you know, playing some type of sim game.
Oh, yeah, totally. But, you know, part of the managerial challenge in any large company is you do operate from a level of detachment, right? Only so many people can actually be on the front line. But the mistake that I think they've made in business education and doubled down on it is that you can actually learn enough to be effective at making decisions that are real and that involve real people and so many inputs other than a spreadsheet. That's another thing. You know, MBAs are spreadsheet and measurement happy. And as a result of that, we have as a culture and but particularly as in our economy, overvalued things we can measure at the expense of things that are harder to measure, like quality, satisfaction, community, intention. You know, it's far easier to mention or to measure cost per unit and to make a decision to fire a bunch of people because that'll help change that variable a little bit. It's reductive and it puts too much emphasis on a single aspect of business rather than, you know, taking it holistically.
How much of that particular dynamic where you talk about quantifying and measuring and getting sort of data, how much of that is a function of the bringing in Michael Jensen, the Dean MacArthur era at Harvard Business School, where you're talking about, you know, shareholder value, where you're talking about where you're really teaching a financialization of companies in some way, it seems to me.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things that was actually, I hadn't grasped it in any, real way before I was working on this book, was that one of the big influences in business education for decades, and one of the pressures that isn't so obvious to the outside is that there was some what you'd call basically penis envy among business faculties when comparing themselves to those in the hard sciences, right? If you're a physicist, you do experiments, you can measure stuff. And if you're a chemist, and one of the big mistakes that business education made early on, and, you know, it started in the at a time when Americans' belief in the benefits of science was at a high, is that business is essentially a science and that you can study it scientifically. And sure, there's you know, if you're trying to design a factory to make things cheaply, you're going to want to use a lot of numbers looking at your inputs and your outputs. But they went way too far down that rabbit hole, and you have someone like Michael Jensen coming in with all sorts of basically incomprehensible equations and arguments that that they're completely ideologically driven ideas right? The central one being that shareholders are the true owners of a company. And kind of masquerading as if it had scientific backup to it. You know, one of the lines I quote from Jensen in the book is, 200 years of work in economics and finance implies that in the absence of externalities and monopoly, social welfare is maximized when each firm in an economy maximizes its total market value, right? That sounds like science. It's an opinion. And what the business schools did for far too long was pretend and aspire to a kind of scientific certainty to their ideas, when anyone who thinks about it for 5 seconds understands that business is about people, right? And while we have some biological science inside us, people interacting is sociology. It is not science. And their desire to make their work seem like it had the benefit of scientific inquiry behind it was both a charade and a tragedy.
Isn't it also a function of, that is my experience, and I'm trying to not be terribly sort of predisposed towards business, but to me, it just, my experience is just that there's just so much BS involved in it that it's a surprise that anything actually gets done. But isn't that, in the context of that school, isn't the idea to make everything scientific, and we see it in the context of politics a little bit too, the more technocratic you make it, the more supposedly absent of ideology is there, and that it is really a way of justifying some assumptions that you have that are just assumptions that you've simply decided are going to be the baseline. So there is a certain capitalistic dynamic that seems to me is taken for granted. And then from there, you sort of reverse engineer it and justify it by saying, well, this is just the way things are. And we now have a way of observing them and quantifying them.
Right. And, you know, the obvious one is the insistence that management is apolitical, right? What you've got in a capitalist firm, a for-profit firm, is extraction of value from your employees and the redirecting of that value elsewhere. Nothing could be more political than that. And yet they hide behind this idea that, it has dispassionate inquiry, scientific inquiry behind it. When essentially, you know, what is management? It's an exercise in motivation and control, right? And I've said in a number of places in the book that Harvard Business School should better be thought of as a school of rhetoric than anything else. They are teaching students how to talk the talk and walk the walk of a specific role in a capitalist system. I'm not anti-capitalism, but the idea that it's anything but a training ground and breeder of like-minded people who are either unwilling or unable to face the assumptions they make about the work that they do. You know, if one societal group is going to dominate another, call it managers over workers, it's way easier to stomach it if you can convince yourself that what you're doing is science, not mind control.
Right. I mean, there's a whole amount. I think you write that they say that they teach their students not what to think, but how to think, which seems to me to be part and parcel of that. And also the concept of leadership that you write about, when they come in and there's this sense that there's a sense that when you get into Harvard Business School, that they're going to churn out the value isn't already there, or I should say the status isn't already there. I mean, it seems to me if you get into Harvard Business School, that is tells you as much about where you've come from as it does as to where you're going.
Sure. Although that's an issue with all the elite universities in the country, and that's not just an MBA issue, right? We are socioeconomically divided, and you know, leadership potential is another way of saying what luxuries were you afforded in your formative years. But you know, here's a great example. Like they pride themselves on teaching leadership. But if you look closely, the bar is so low, it's almost unbelievable. One of their most cherished graduates and case studies is about a guy named James Burke, who was CEO of Johnson & Johnson during the Tylenol poisonings in the 1980s. And when that happened, you know, Johnson & Johnson immediately recalled all the Tylenol. And within short order had introduced the safety caps that we now know on all over-the-counter medications. And he was widely praised for his sense of social responsibility, which he attributed the source of it he attributed to the Johnson & Johnson corporate credo. Which said, you know, we put community first. And to that I say, number one, he certainly wasn't acting irresponsibly, but it's hardly worth praise to pour excessive praise on someone for recalling a bunch of things that could be poisoned, right?
Right.
What else are you going to do? And then also for him to actually say, you know, the way I was able to get the $400 million cost of the recall by our board was by pointing to our credo. It's like, did you really need to go read a piece of corporate propaganda to tell you what you should do here? Like, did you actually need to go and say, oh, yes, I find all the answers in the ancient papers of Johnson & Johnson? You know, if the bar for being a socially responsible executive is to recall potentially poisoned product so that no one else dies, that's about as low a bar as you could ask for.
I mean, I got to say, I've interviewed a lot of plaintiff attorneys over the past years, and it's stunning to me the how low that bar can go. In that context, but I want to talk about this ownership society, because one of the things that Bill Lozonik from UMass has talked about is in the 1980s when the capital gains tax changed, and also the idea that you could buy back your own stocks changed as a corporation. That it created these sort of misaligned incentives for the leadership of a company versus sort of like the long-term health of a company, which would include theoretically the its workers and the broader community, arguably the, you know, in different sort of concentric circles of what constitutes a community. And how much of that, how much of Harvard Business School's sort of adopting that shareholder stake model was a function of those government policy changes? I mean, what was the relationship there, and how much of our financialization sort of, how much did Harvard Business School change when it became very much about seeing these companies as a financial instrument?
You know, I've had some really worthwhile correspondence with retired HBS professor named Bruce Scott about this subject, where he was trying to make the point to me that I missed some of the significant forces at play in the 70s leading to the 80s, and that, yes, there were, you know, structural and tax shifts that, you know, changed the course of how American companies were run in a far more significant way than
whatever silly ideas Michael Jensen was pushing at the time. But the fact that you had the nation's most prominent business school, its most prominent professor for the decade of greed in the 80s, was a guy who said things like leverage buyouts don't destroy value, they create it, blanket statement. Or golden parachutes are good for shareholders, blanket statement. They were basically giving intellectual cover to what was nothing other than a narrowing of purpose among the managerial class to their own self-interest. And to actually have served as the instrument of intellectual validation of greed, it's shameful and also hypocritical of a school who claimed to be doing just the opposite. And it's astounding to me that they knowingly hired someone who would attract significant corporate donations to the school because the theories he was pushing, lined up so well with the people at those companies who controlled, the same people who were okaying donations to build new buildings at Harvard Business School are the ones who are awarding themselves stock options. It was a circle jerk, and that's what they've been doing for decades.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like an accelerant to me. I mean, the idea that we're not only we're going to have sort of a broader context where we sort of encourage these misaligned incentives, but we're going to provide an entire academic body of work that tells you you're doing the exact right thing. And it just so coincidentally is lining your pockets.
Yeah, and you know, the first excerpt from the book was about Michael Jensen in Newsweek. So there's been a lot of focus on it, but if you want any more evidence of just how vacant this man's theories are, one of his more recent papers has been an attempt to scientifically prove the necessity of integrity in business. And it's like, I'm sorry, first of all, you're proving this with some more formulas, but a bunch of nonsense scribblings, and telling us something A, that we already knew, and B, that you were one of the most significant forces driving any sense of integrity out of business for a decade. Apparently, he's come around. Some of the people at Harvard complained that I focused on Jensen, and I'm too focused on Jensen, and they moved on. They have moved on. And it's like, well, I focused on him at the part of the history that is relevant to him. And if HBS has woken up to the idiocy of his ideas, the society has not moved on. The short-termism, the share price as our North Star, the sense of self in the managerial class as, that they reduced themselves to their own base motives. All of these things are still being felt every single day. So they may have moved on, but the damage is done.
And many of those things if not directly, certainly sort of tangentially responsible for the 2008 financial crisis.
Yeah, the 2008 financial crisis had all sorts of causes, right? And one of them was the detachment we've talked about. If you can sit in an office in Manhattan and be like rolling the dice on monstrous one-way real estate bets that are over-leveraging entire institutions, it makes sense that people couldn't really understand what they were doing, the risks they were taking in a leveraged one-way bet, especially when everyone was taking it. But the other thing is, it's like the fact of the stock compensation and stock price-driven decision-making just led everyone down the very same path into betting the farm for personal gain, for your personal bonus that year. And, you know, so detached decision makers making huge bets with other people's money, with potentially destabilizing effects if they went wrong, not being concerned about that because you're probably going to pocket your bonus before the roof falls in. And, you know, add it all up and you've got a recipe for crisis.
All right. So lastly, I mean, where is HBS claims that Jensen is in the rearview mirror? What are they teaching now? I mean, is there this is the leading business institution in the country, and we have a real problem with business in this country not perceiving their fate to be in any way intertwined with the fate of the communities they're based in, you know, like I say, however that is defined, however broadly, or with the interests of their workers. I mean, what is Harvard Business School teaching now?
You know, they've jumped on the entrepreneurial bandwagon, right? Every MBA wants to get in on the technology gold rush, start an app. They, thankfully, millennial students have been pushing for more of a sustainability and social responsibility component than they had for years, despite claiming to have one. But, you know, the big gaps are clearly, it's still an analytical-driven, finance-driven, measurement-driven approach to decision-making. One of the things that, you know, one of their most famous professors, Michael Porter, the idea he's pushing all the time is give business more control over things like education and healthcare because we can fix them. It's like, what evidence do you have for that? That these methods that, you know, arguably, sure, if it's just a manufacturing operation, yeah, you could probably run it by spreadsheet. But you want to go all the way into healthcare and tell us that we should spreadsheet this till the bitter end. They are still 100% behind the notion that we can analyze our way to prosperity as opposed to think our way to prosperity. And it's just, you know, the faculty there are not, they're not a faculty in the sense that they're supposed to be. These people are businessmen themselves, businessmen and businesswomen that are for-profit operations with their own institutes and consulting firms and whatever. And all they're seeking to do is maximize for themselves. It's The Economist ran a review of the book that said one idea that they could do is Harvard could spin this thing off and just call it what it is, a business.
Right.
That would at least be honest.
Well, it's a fascinating book. The Golden Passport, Harvard Business School, The Limits of Capitalism and the Moral Failure of the MBA Elite. Duff McDonald, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Are gonna kick in, and my power. Shifted in.